Good morning. The court calls United States v. Neely. Please.
Chief Judge Baker, judges of the court, may it please the court, I am Captain Krista McGrory, and along with Colonel Patricia Hamm, we represent the appellant, Private Darian Neely. Appellant's plea of guilty to provoking speech cannot stand in this case because provoking speech is not an LIO communicating a threat, and as a result, appellant's plea was improper where the military judge failed to inform him that he was pleading guilty to an offense not charged. Additionally, because provoking speech is not an LIO, appellant's court-martial lacked jurisdiction over the Article 117 terms. In Jones, this court returned...
Counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why isn't this waived?
Yes.
This court-martial was August 2010. Miller was June 09. Jones was April 10. They were on notice it wasn't an LIO. He pled anyway. Why isn't this a case of clear waiver?
Yes, Your Honor. First, RCM 907, jurisdictional issues are never waived. Second, RCM 910, guilty plea only waives issues as far as factual guilt. In this case, the appellant's right to due process is at stake. And when there's a constitutional right at stake, there's a presumption against waiver.
Counsel, this court has already looked at the jurisdictional question and rejected the argument, didn't we? The majority of the court.
As far as in U.S. v. Girard, Your Honor?
Yes.
In this case, it's different, Your Honor. There was absolutely no constructive referral. There was no amendment to the charge sheet in this case. In fact, and I apologize, this isn't in the joint appendix, but the government went forward on the charge. So there was no agreement and absolutely no convening authority approval as far as amending the charge. So there was no amendment to the charge, nor was there a constructive referral in this case. And a pleading guilty to an uncharged offense, that was not charged, that was not charged against him, there was no referral in this case.
Let's be careful with what you're saying. There was a referral in this case.
There was a referral of the original charge, yes, Your Honor. But there was not a referral of the Article 117 offense to which he ultimately attempted to plead guilty, nor was there an amendment to the charge sheet or a constructive referral as set forth in Wilkins, where the court held that the referral is the personal decision of the convening authority, and that although the form of the order doesn't necessarily have to be in writing, there does need to be evidence of an actual order of referral, which there is no evidence in this case, as the military judge did not amend the charge sheet. The trial counsel did not attempt to amend the charge sheet, in fact, went forward on the 134. So there was no constructive referral in this case.
Unless I'm remembering incorrectly, there wasn't that neither Girard nor McMurrin turned out constructive referral of rejecting the jurisdictional issue. Let's assume, just for the sake of argument, that we reject your jurisdictional argument in this case also. Where does that leave you?
That leaves, again, Your Honor, addressing the waiver issue. There was no waiver in this case, and that goes directly to the knowing and voluntariness of the plea. And in this case, the appellant's plea is improvident, as the military judge erroneously applied the law and abused his discretion.
Well, how?
In that he failed to conduct the elements test. It's evident from the record, Your Honor, that not a single person that was a party to this court-martial believed that the appellant was pleading up to an uncharged offense. Each party erroneously believed that Article 117 was a lesser-included offense of the Article 134.
Well, counsel, let me just ask you this. What element of Article 117 was not explained to appellant, and what element of Article 117 was not explained to him by the military judge?
Your Honor, specifically, he was not informed that it was an uncharged offense against
him. That wasn't my question. My question was, what element was not explained to him, and what element did he not agree that he was guilty of?
As far as the Article 117, the 117 elements were explained to him. It's the fact that...
So, but this is my question, counsel. What is the prejudice here? Because let's say at the time, or they're at the time, and someone says, oh my goodness, You know, we just realized that Jones and Miller were decided, and this is not an LIO. What would have happened, do you think? I mean, one of two things. Either he would have said, oh my gosh, I don't care, I still want to plead guilty, or he would have said, oh my gosh, this specification is defective, at which point in time the government could withdraw it, re-refer it, and there'd be no problem whatsoever. So what is the prejudice when everything has been explained to him, and he's pleaded guilty, and he had his pretrial agreement?
Your Honor,
other than the fact of the error itself.
Your Honor, in this case, not everything was explained to him. And the fact that he was pleading guilty to an offense not charged was not explained to him. And that goes back to Medina, as far as an accused needs to be aware of the nature of the offense for which he is pleading guilty. That would include the fact that he's pleading guilty to an uncharged offense. Even though all the elements of the 117 were explained to him, we can't tell from the record whether or not he would have still pled guilty had he known he was pleading to an uncharged
offense. But that doesn't answer my question. What is the prejudice? There's an error, but it's quite clear under United States, under Puckett versus United States, and every other case that I'm aware of, that the mere fact of error itself doesn't supply the prejudice. You need to show some prejudice. What's the prejudice?
The prejudice goes directly to the knowing involuntariness of his plea. And
that's the error.
The prejudice is that he was convicted of an offense not charged against him, and that he...
Counsel,
yes, Your Honor.
Let's assume for a moment it's forfeited and not waived. And now, following up on Judge Ryan, where's the prejudice? He got a derisory sentence, even in the absence of a ETA, for offenses that included stabbing a senior NCO. Where's prejudice?
Your Honor, it goes back to the fact that the prejudice is that he was convicted of an offense not charged against him. And we simply cannot say...
Judge Ryan's pointed out that's the error, not the prejudice.
We simply cannot say from the record that he would have pled guilty to this Article 117 offense had he known that it was an uncharged offense. And the prejudice is the fact that the military judge failed to advise him of that and did not let him enter into a full knowing and voluntary plea. Thus, he was prejudiced by entering into a plea he simply did not know was an offense charged against him.
So he's prejudiced by entering into a plea for an offense for which the maximum punishment is what?
The maximum punishment is 6 months confinement, Your Honor, with 6 months forfeiture and no punitive discharge.
And he was prejudiced by not being able to be tried and convicted for an offense which would have had a punishment of what?
I believe 2 years confinement and a punitive discharge, Your Honor.
Perhaps 3 years.
3 years, yes, Your Honor. The prejudice simply goes to the fact, it goes directly to the providency of the plea. And in this case, there is a substantial basis in law and fact to question this appellant's plea of guilty, the basis being in law, in that the military judge erroneously applied the law in this case, failed to apply the elements test that was set forth in Jones, therefore failing to advise the appellant that he was pleading guilty to an offense not charged against him.
Is there a requirement in law that there actually be a physical amendment to the charge sheet in order for changes to be made to the charges?
While there's not an actual requirement of a physical change, Your Honor, there must be some indication on the record if there is a major change.
If the trial counsel had said in this case, we'd prefer to try this case as provoking words under Article 117, and the military judge said to the defense counsel, do you have any objection to that? And defense counsel said, no objection, Your Honor. Would we be in a position of error if there was no physical change made to the charge sheet?
There would still have to be some indication of the convening authority's approval of the major amendment, because in this case, the major amendment is changing the offense, which amounts to essentially a confirmed referral.
So that it's error if the convening authority, if the trial counsel makes the change, the judge approves it, the defense counsel approves it, it's still an error if the convening authority has not acted on it.
The referral of charges is solely in the discretion of the convening authority. Therefore, there must be some indication that the convening authority approved this major change, which ultimately changes the offense.
That's your jurisdictional argument.
Yes, Your Honor. And in this case, there simply was no jurisdiction, as unlike Wilkins, where the military judge did go over the fact with providency that this was, the appellant was pleading guilty to an uncharged offense, and there was an offer to plead guilty, which exemplified the fact that the convening authority agreed to this.
In what case would you cite as an example where this court has held that there was no jurisdiction in the absence of action on the charge by the convening authority when all the parties at trial agreed to a change?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of a specific case where no jurisdiction was held, but looking to the precise language of Wilkins, which says there needs to be convening authority action, I think it's evident from the opinion in Wilkins that there needs to be approval by the convening authority, hence a constructive referral.
Can you cite to either a statute or a rule that requires that? In particular, does the rule on changes to the charge sheet expressly require convening authority action?
RCM 601, Your Honor, does not explicitly say it needs convening authority action.
So why should we read that into it?
Because that was the holding in Wilkins.
I understand that was a discussion in Wilkins that may or not have been essential to the case. And they were not presented in Wilkins with the issue that you've raised in this case now. So why should we apply that principle for the first time in this case?
Reading 601 in conjunction with RCM 201 Bravo, Your Honor, saying each charge needs to be referred to the court-martial, a major amendment which changes the offense, it needs to be referred to a court-martial.
So, do you think it makes a difference that the change to the offense made it a lesser offense as opposed to changing the offense to make it a greater offense?
Not where the offense is not necessarily included, Your Honor. It's still a separate and distinct offense that needs to be referred to a court-martial. Had it been an actual lesser-included offense, obviously then it would not have to be referred as it would be necessarily included.
What's the theory behind convening authority referral, if any?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What is the theory behind convening authority referral?
In this case?
In any case. Why have the rule?
That in order for charges to actually be referred, it's the personal discretion of the convening authority, which is based also on the advice of the SJA and theoretically having reviewed the evidence and making a decision to refer to a particular court-martial. It's the individual decision of the convening authority. And again, in this case, there was no referral, whether it be constructive, whether it be an amendment to the charge sheet. There simply was no referral in this case. There was no agreement between the parties. In fact, the trial counsel went forward on the 134 offense, showing that the convening authority did not consent to the changing of the specification.
Counsel, with respect to future proceedings in this case, if we agree with you on the jurisdictional argument, is your client then subject to punishment for a dishonorable discharge and 3 years confinement if there's no jurisdiction in the court-martial at the first time?
He was found not guilty of the 134, Your Honor, so we believe he would be limited in scope to the punishment of the 117 offense, although he could be retried on the 117 offense. Pending your questions, I'll save the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Good Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, may I speak to the court? I'm Captain Ken Bornito, along with my co-counsel, Mr. Catherine Gow, represent the governor's appellee. This case presents two legal issues. The first is, does the court still utilize the pleadings elements analysis when employing the elements test? And the second is whether appellant was prejudiced when he was convicted of an offense for which he was not charged with. Turning to the first question, the government's position is that the pleadings elements test announced in United States versus Weymouth is still good law even following United States versus Jones, because United States versus Jones did not explicitly overrule that decision and that line of thinking. United States versus Weymouth initially is consistent with United States versus Jones, because Jones noted it overruled only those post-Teeters cases that have deviated from the elements test. United States versus Weymouth, by its own terms, explicitly applied the elements test and explicitly rejected the inherent relationship test. While Jones was merely a case involving what test was going to be applied, Weymouth was the case describing how that specific test, the elements test, was going to be applied. So under the circumstances of this case, dealing with the charge of the greater offense of Article 134, communicating a threat, and the supposed lesser of Article 117, provoking speech or gestures, under the facts of this case, while the government concedes it is not an LIO here.
You concede that it's not an LIO?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. What's left?
What's left here?
What's left after that concession?
Well, then what's left after that is defining the nature of the error as the error being the appellant's conviction for an offense for which he was not charged. Pursuant to the line of the line of cases Jones, McMurrin, and Girard, this court tests for plain error. And obviously, as in those cases, the court found that it was obviously plain error for appellant to be convicted of an offense for which he was not charged. The question is whether appellant was prejudiced by that conviction. And then, as McMurrin made explicitly clear, the conviction itself cannot be alone what establishes prejudice, because of the fact that McMurrin pointed out it's not structural error. So there must be something in addition to the conviction itself which establishes prejudice for appellant. This case is distinguishable from those in Girard and McMurrin, where the court did find prejudice. In Girard and McMurrin, the court found that there was never any change or amendment requested or made to the charge sheet. The accused in those cases did not defend himself on a theory that he was not guilty of the greater, but guilty of the lesser. And the government in those cases did not try the case on a theory that the accused was guilty of the lesser included offense. And so therefore, he was not on notice of that point. And so therefore, there was prejudice in that case. This case is entirely different based on the fact that appellant was the one who voluntarily brought forward the charge that he wanted to be charged with. He was the one who specifically amended the specification and submitted it as an appellate exhibit of what he wanted the specification to be, voluntarily pled guilty, voluntarily admitted to all the facts and circumstances surrounding his plea. And so there is therefore no allegation of prejudice in this case that could be raised regarding.
Well, counsel, let's start with the jurisdictional argument. Which, would you agree that the jurisdictional argument does not require prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor.
So, first of all, to cover, let's see if we have agreement on the point that I last asked defense counsel about. In this case, given the outcome of the trial, can the accused be retried on the issue of communicating a threat, or is the not guilty finding on that dispositive? Should there be a ruling in the favor of the defense on the jurisdictional issue?
I believe the government's position would be that the finding of not guilty as the 130 defense would dispose of that.
Okay, so now we're talking about retrying on provoking words. If there's a ruling in the favor of defense by this court, he can be retried again on that.
Yes, Your Honor, because jeopardy would not attach.
And how would that apply to the sentencing of everything that goes on in this case? That is, where would the maximum be in this case?
Well, likely the maximum would remain the same, because since he was acquitted of the 134, the maximum was whatever with the 117, the 6 months and the no kick, in relative to the other remaining charges.
Right, he's got other charges in the case. So what's the maximum in this case that he would be facing if there's a retrial that includes the 117.
And I forget explicitly whether the maximum punishment was facing, but it would obviously be reduced by the 6 months if the 117 was dismissed on jurisdictional grounds.
Okay. Then what would that have to then be a separate trial on 117 if the government decided to go ahead on that?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe at this point, since jurisdiction and jeopardy are never attached, it would essentially be bringing a separate charge on a separate trial.
Now let's talk about the jurisdictional aspect of it. As you pointed out, the language on 117, bringing 117 in the case, was initiated by the defense. Can a defendant charge himself or herself in a court-martial?
No, Your Honor.
So, for example, if he had a one-day AWOL, could a person come in and plead guilty to a more serious offense?
No, Your Honor.
So what's going on here, and why is this different?
Well, obviously, the difference in this case, Your Honor, comes in the difference between the Wilkins line of cases and then the Gerard, McMurrin, and Jones analysis, where Gerard and McMurrin find that what essentially has occurred was a major change. So they found that it was not a jurisdictional issue that occurred in the trial because charges had been properly referred, the court was properly convened. And so what the court analyzed the issue as the change in from the greater to the supposed lesser was essentially a major change and not a jurisdictional defect where the change to the charge was not jurisdictionally improper. And I think you can see from the difference between, and the court doesn't go into explicit.
So a major change can be made without the approval of the convening authority?
Apparently, yes, Your Honor.
How does that fit into your answer to my earlier question? That is, if somebody's charged with a one-day AWOL, can that be changed to a more serious offense?
And that's the issue that's not been explicitly addressed regarding the bounds of what is allowed to be changed, what essentially are acceptable major changes, and what how broad a change can be before it becomes jurisdictional. That's what is essentially...
Well, help us out. What's the government's theory on that?
Well, the government's theory, and without going to the necessarily defining the outer bounds, the government can point to the difference between the Wilkins line of cases and then the Jones, Gerard, and McMurrin line of cases. In Wilkins, what you had was a charge of charged with larceny. The appellant then came in and tried to plead guilty to receiving stolen property. Two charges that were clearly not lesser-included offenses. There was never any discussion that they could be. There were two totally separate offenses in that larceny and receiving stolen property are based on totally separate acts and totally separate criminal effects to those points. So completely different conduct in those cases. Whereas when you look at specifically Gerard and McMurrin, what you have is a greater offense of premeditated murder. With the supposed lesser offense of negligent homicide. Both offenses based on the exact same conduct. All you have is a difference in intent and a difference in the legal effect of that conduct. And that's closer to what you have in this case because of the fact that he's charged with communicating a threat. The supposed lesser was provoking speech or gestures. Both of them were speech crimes. And both of them, as pled, the conduct and the language of the 134 offense was identical to the language that appellant pled to under 117. So you have the exact same conduct. The only issue is the different legal effect and the intent of those statements and the effect of those statements. So this case is closer to that idea of Gerard and McMurrin, wherein that was considered a change there and not a jurisdictional defect. So here, this type of change from 134 to 117 shouldn't necessarily fall into Wilkins' line.
How about this as a simpler theory? I'm not necessarily advocating it, just asking for your reaction to it. If at the time of a court-martial proceeding, an offense is listed by the president as a lesser-included offense within the manual for courts-martial, even though as a matter of law that may be outside the president's authority, if it's listed there, for purposes of determining whether something is a lesser-included offense with respect to constructive amendment of the charges, that's all that's needed.
I don't know, in every case that would be all that was needed, but I believe that would be a factor that could be considered in the analysis of as to whether or not that removes the change into a jurisdictional parameter.
Counsel, I have a question a little bit off this track as to the specific language that we're talking about here. What he was alleged to have said or charged as saying was, I have an ammo round with Staff Sergeant Fern's name on it. And that was initially charged as communicating a threat. And obviously later changed, he pled guilty to provoking language. And my question is whether or not that language in itself is provident to provoking language. What we're looking at in provoking language is what we've termed fighting words or words that will provoke a violent response. I can certainly see the argument that language could be construed as communicating a threat, but how does it provoke a violent response? It did here, but I mean, how? I'm just wondering whether or not it could.
Right, John, and that's why the government conceded just on the language itself, on the face of the specification, why the 117 charge in this case is not a lesser offense of the 134, because the statement charges a threat in and of itself is not necessarily provoking to put an accused on notice. But within the providence of this plea, appellant was able to explain the circumstances of why he made the statement, how the statement was made, was it within the hearing of the individual, and then was able to explain, apparently to the judge's satisfaction, that why that statement could have been provoking in that circumstance.
And where did he explain why it could have been provoking?
I believe in his providence inquiry, just explained regarding the fact that the definition was given regarding what provident or what provoking speech entails.
I thought he said that he said it so that he could, that the staff sergeant would get him to turn in his rifle. Turn in his weapon so that he wouldn't have to do this extra guard duty.
Right, I don't recall that specific point. I just recall going through his province inquiry. I mean, he mentioned the circumstances and the facts of the case there regarding what he said and the circumstances there and why he believed that it was provoking, and the military judge agreed. And so the question that was to be reviewed, whether or not the plea is even provident, would be whether or not the military judge abused his discretion in accepting the plea. And the government's position would be that it may not have been the most in-depth analysis of why it was provoking speech, but at least would have met the legal standard to meet provoking in there. Because of the fact, based on his description, while it may not necessarily on its face be provoking, the statement, when described in the province inquiry, the circumstances, it could lead to the finding that it was provoking.
I understand your major change argument. As a separate matter, what is the theory behind CA referral of charges?
The theory behind it in general, Your Honor? Mm-hmm. Just the theory that a court-martial lacks jurisdiction to, or essentially exists until the convening authority refers charges to it to essentially convene the court. That's why there's a convening order, which...
Why have the convening authority do it versus anybody else?
Why have a convening authority do it?
Right. Because why is that a function assigned to the convening authority? What's the theory behind that?
My understanding is just the concept that the General Court Martial Convening Authority is the one who has the power to convene courts martials. I believe it's by statute, and then therefore they are the ones who can therefore stand up the court martial and determine what charges are to be brought before that court martial against an individual accused.
So that's not a theory, but rather just a statement of what happens.
Correct, Your Honor. And I'm not sure.
You can't imagine a theory here.
Well, I'm not sure about the exact theory. I mean, I understand that the convening authority is the one who determines what charges are to be brought in general, and so they're the ones who therefore refer the charge.
And in this case, what is the government's view as to what charge was or was not referred?
Well, the charge referred was obviously the 134, communicating a threat. And then the issue comes down
to... So the government is not taking the view that the 117 was constructively referred or otherwise referred. They're taking the view that it's a major change.
Correct, Your Honor, because of the fact that under the Wilkins line of cases, we don't have the Wilkins exception where we have a constructive referral by order of the convening authority.
It's not a trick question. I just want to make sure I understand your position clearly.
Correct, Your Honor. The government's position tracks with Gerard and McMurrin regarding essentially treating what happened here as a major change and not a jurisdictional referral.
But you're not finding a constructive referral or anything like that?
No, Your Honor.
Why are you abandoning constructive referral? What did the meaning for courts martial say at the time that this case was referred to trial?
Well, yes, Your Honor. At the time, the manual for court-martial listed 117 as a lesser-included offense.
So, for purposes of jurisdiction, why isn't that a constructive referral? Why wouldn't the convening authority, if the convening authority looked at the manual for courts-martial, say, oh, when I'm referring the communicating a threat charge, I'm also referring the lesser-included offense of provoking words and gestures? It may well be that as a matter of law, that the individual cannot be convicted of provoking words and gestures under Jones, etc. But for purposes of the convening authority's attitude and exercise of power, why isn't that a constructive referral? After all, referring a charge doesn't necessarily mean that the court martial will convict on it or that the court martial will not have other legal problems with the case.
Yes, Your Honor, and that could be a theory to find a constructive referral, the fact that it was listed as a lesser included offense in the MCM at the time.
Well, the question is, what is the government's position? Is the government position Judge Efron's position, or is the government's position as previously stated? Please pony up your position here.
Well, the government's position is, as previously stated, based on the Gerard McMurrin major change line of cases. The government had not analyzed it under the concept that the convening authority his intent could have been inferred from the fact that the MCM listed as a lesser included offense. And that depends on how the court analyzes the intent at the time. Do you look at the intent based solely on the fact that it's listed as an LIO, or will the court analyze the intent? Inferring...
Thus, in summary, the government's position is what?
In summary, the government's position is pursuant to Gerard and McMurrin, the change in this case from Article 134 to 117 is essentially a major change, or is treated as such as a major change, and therefore the error is tested for plain error and prejudice, and it's not a jurisdictional defect.
Thank you.
Pending any further questions? In conclusion, the government requests that this court continue to uphold the pleadings elements test in the United States versus Wingler and find that appellant in this case, though 117 was not a lesser included offense under the facts of this case, find that appellant was not prejudiced by his conviction or from the findings and sentence in this case. Thank you.
Is there a rebuttal, please?
A few brief points. To the extent that Weymouth used the language fairly implied, we do believe it has been overruled by Jones. We have now moved to necessarily included. So to the extent that Weymouth uses fairly implied, it has been overruled. The standard of review in this case, we believe, should be abuse of discretion with issues from the guilty plea dealing with the law reviewed de novo. McMurrin and Gerard were contested cases in which the instruction were reviewed for plain error. But in this case, again, the fact that he pled to an uncharged offense goes directly to the knowing and voluntariness of the plea. So the standard of review should be abuse of discretion with legal matters being reviewed de novo. Contrary to the government's position, there was simply no major change in this case. The government went forward on the 134 offense, showing there was no convening authority approval to amend the charge sheet, nor was there an actual amendment to the document, nor an agreement between the parties as to changing the document. There simply was no jurisdiction over this separate and uncharged offense.
Counsel, two things. First, with respect to the convening authority's action, why can't we presume that the convening authority referred the charge of provoking words and gestures when, if the convening authority looked at the manual for courts martial and saw that it was a lesser included offense at that time, that would have been a proper referral?
There is absolutely no indication from the record in this case, Your Honor, that the convening authority intended to refer the Article 117 offense.
Why does there have to be anything on the face of the record? Why can't we look at the manual for courts martial for what would have been before any convening authority at that time?
There has to be, according to Wilkins, although the order itself, the form of the order is not important, there must be an order referring a charge to a court-martial. And there, it did not happen in this case. In fact, the government went forward on the 134 offense, which clearly indicates...
Counsel, I don't think you're focusing on my question. My question is, if we're looking at what the convening authority referred to trial, and if at the time the manual for courts-martial lists communicating a threat, and below that list, provoking words as a lesser included, why can't we presume that those are all the offenses that the convening authority referred to trial? Doesn't a convening authority always have the power to refer to trial? And indeed, the referral includes everything that's listed as a lesser included offense. It may be that there's a defect in a charge. For example, if the terminal element is left out of an Article 134 offense, that can then be raised at trial. But a defect in a charge doesn't necessarily raise jurisdiction, does it?
Well, Your Honor, the manual is only a persuasive authority. And at the time this case went to trial, Jones had been initiated. So therefore, it was not a lesser included offense.
But then why isn't your entire case waived? If you want to rely on the fact that Jones and Miller were decided for purposes of undermining what the convening authority did in this case, why doesn't that waive your argument with respect to the conviction under Article 117?
Because the rights at stake in this case, Your Honor, are due process and his right not to be convicted of an uncharged offense. Because of that, there's a presumption against waiver, and in order for waiver to be effective, in a case involving constitutional rights, there must be something on the record indicating there was a knowing and intelligent waiver. And that didn't happen in this case because clearly every person party to this court martial erroneously believed that 117 was an LIO. There's simply not enough in the record to establish a waiver.
Do you understand now how that goes to Judge Efron's point, which is that if indeed that's what the convening authority assumed when he referred to Article 134 offense, where do you get from that a jurisdictional defect? Whether there's a major change to the specification or not, why is there a jurisdictional defect if the convening authority, when he referred to Article 134, also believed he was referring to everything that was listed in the manual of the court martial, even if your client had pleaded not guilty and then contested the validity of your specification? Do you see what I'm saying? Then they would have an argument under Gerard McMurrin that there was error and that they were prejudiced. But do you see why the guilty plea places this in a different context?
Your Honor, I think there's just simply not enough evidence in the record in this case to make the leap that the convening authority intended to refer the 117 offense. The listing of it in the manual is persuasive authority. Therefore, you can't make that leap that he intended to refer to 117 when it's clearly not the LIO. So the fact that it's persuasive, we can't then attribute that to an actual referral by the convening authority.
It's a persuasive to everybody except the convening authority.
It's persuasive authority, not binding, Your Honor. So therefore, we can't attribute it to the convening authority, and there's simply no evidence that the convening authority intended to refer that charge to the court martial. And again, unlike Wilkins, there was no offer to plead guilty in this case, so you can't hold there was a constructive referral.
Your time is up. Would you like to say anything else?
Pending your questions, Your Honor, I'll end the argument.
Thank you, counsel. The case is now submitted. And we will stand in recess until 20 past the hour. Thank you.